purposeful play,
purposeful work,
rugged outdoor living,
everyone to the farm and conservation efforts podcast.
My name is W. I'm director of camps here at Farm Wilderness, and I'm so glad you're back with us this week. We took a couple weeks off. We had a camp director retreat. We went to the New England American Camp Association conference. So it has been a busy time, and it is going to get busier as we get closer to camp. I'm very excited about my guest this week, and guest is a bit of a misnomer. After this, I'm really going to metaphorically hand the mic off over to her. Christy Webb, who is the granddaughter of the founders of Farm and Wilderness, Ken and Susan Webb, is here today to share some excerpts from the book that she recently re-released with some updates, Beyond Our Wildest Dreams. You recognize that name and have listened to us for a little bit, you'll know that that is the book that we have used often on this podcast to talk about the history of farm and wilderness. It's really great to have her come on board and share some of her favorite parts from the book, think about the future for farm and wilderness, and really just her thoughts and reflections. Near the end, you'll actually hear about how she met her partner, and it's a pretty great story. And with that, I'm handing over the mic to Christy Webb, who's reading excerpts from Beyond Our Wildest Dreams.
I want to be sure to say thank you so much for inviting me onto the podcast. I love listening to the podcast. I'm always excited to get a new episode. And what an honor to be invited to contribute to it. That's really exciting. Plus, I love talking about the camps. Very few things make me happier than talking about camp. Being at camp, that makes me happier. So I want to share some excerpts from Beyond Our Wildest Dreams and perhaps explain first what the book is. In the early 80s, Grandpa Ken, my Ken Webb, wanted to write a book that was the history of the farm and wilderness camps. Of course, it was his version of the history of the farm and wilderness camps. And as he approached his death, which was in 1984, even then he was working on editing it. When family members would gather at Brook's End, he would have one of us read it out loud to him, and he would make corrections and say, no, change this word, or no, put a comma there, or no, that's not right. I don't like how I expressed that. And we would edit it as we went. After his death, Grandma took up the book and had it published originally for the 50th anniversary of the Farm and Wilderness Camps. So in 1989. And while both Grandma and Grandpa were very optimistic people, Grandpa was a visionary and he was enthusiastic. There was nothing that we couldn't do. And it was all going to happen and it was all going to be easy. And why couldn't you see it? Grandma was optimistic, but also more pragmatic. And so her vision and her version of the book ended up, the one that was originally published in the first edition, ended up being, I would say, gentler in some ways. She had a longer historical perspective. In the early, in the early 2000s, I started wanting to edit this book because some of it was out of date. Some of the language was infelicitous, reflective of its era, but not of ours. And we had new developments, and finally got to do that, you know, thanks COVID, and was able to publish the second edition, which immediately went out of date. I mean, within about 10 minutes. But there are pieces of the book, lots of them, that are still relevant, that just as they were originally written, listeners will recognize this. For example, early on in the book, if you have your own copy of the book, you can see that it's on page 10. It's written, to begin with, we agreed that there must be challenge in the program. We wanted to approach camping through problem solving to help our campers appreciate the physical environment and develop a sense of wonder at its complexity. Work can be exciting too. However, there had to be more than challenge, simplicity, honesty, and ruggedness were vital. Radio wasn't too much of a problem in those early years and television didn't exist. What children needed as much as anything was plain, old-fashioned caring. They needed to be made to feel important, to have a feeling of success in order to build self-confidence. And I think those words absolutely could be written on our website today, except the part about radio and TV, which are very reflective of those times. But we still have challenge in our program. We still want our campers to appreciate the physical environment and develop a sense of wonder at its complexity. Work can be exciting too. Of course, we say that work is love made visible, which is a quote from Khalil Gibran's book, The Prophet. Simplicity, honesty, and ruggedness. You can hear there the beginnings of the spices, the Quaker principles on which we are founded. She goes on, there was too much competition in a child's world. Cooperation, not competition, became one of our goals. Challenging the campers with work projects, such as building cabins and paths, doing the daily chores, learning the skills needed to live safely in the wilderness, and emphasizing cooperation, we were talking about a whole new set of values. We agreed that there was something else to be added. Children without some sort of spiritual dimension in their lives have missed a vital part of education also. We believe that a camp based on these principles, simplicity, ruggedness, social concern, and the search for spiritual truth, would succeed. This was really unusual in 1939. It's not all that common now. But you know, people often ask, what is the special sauce for Farm and Wilderness? What makes us different from many other truly excellent nonprofit camps in New England and especially in Vermont? And in my opinion, certainly in Grandma and Grandpa's opinion, that special sauce is the fact that we are based in Quaker values, in Quaker principles. Grandma and Grandpa, neither one of them was a birthright friend. Neither one of them had been a Quaker from birth. Their family members were not Quakers. Grandma was, I think, a Congregationalist. But they had become members of the Religious Society of Friends, known as the Quakers, while Grandpa was teaching in Baltimore at the Petty School. But even before that, the testimonies of the friends of simplicity, concern for each other, and the peace spoke to their condition, as friends would say. So we come to the first day of what was at that time called Camp Merlicht. Grandpa had been, they both were teachers. They had both taught. They both had master's degrees in classics. Grandpa taught at the Putney School, at the Petty School in Baltimore. He had taught at the American University of Beirut. And that, in fact, was where he got the idea for camps. He'd always wanted to start a school. The book goes into quite a lot of detail about what it took to get the first camp off the ground. But I love the story of the very first day. There are about 25 little boys arriving. And they're coming, of course. It's not the boys that we had to convince. It's their moms that we had to convince that this was a safe place to leave their children. And so what is now the trading post, folks drove up the hill from where the BDC is now, from the lower barns, and they arrived and they were to park at the trading post. And that's where Grandma and Grandpa were going to be. And unfortunately, for that first day of camp, both my dad and his older sister, Sookie, came down with measles. And Grandma just did not feel that she could leave them. But fortunately, Grandma was an identical twin. And when I say that she was an identical twin, there were points in my life as a child when I could not tell her and her sister, my great Aunt Harriet, whom we called Aunt Harriet, apart. In fact, there are many delightful stories of the two of them interviewing for each other's jobs and so forth. Anyway, Great Aunt Harriet stood right alongside Grandpa Ken and welcomed those families, saying, "We're so glad you're here. Hi, I'm Susan Webb. We're so glad you're here with us." To make these families feel comfortable that they were not just leaving their children, tossing them out of the car into the deep woods of Vermont, even though that is what most of the little boys wanted, I will say. They thought this was the greatest thing ever. But there was hardly a camp there, we have to say. It was called Merlicht in those days, which, as I said, these were Goethe's last words, the German poet Goethe's last words, "more light," which is lovely and very Quaker. But nobody could understand it on the telephone. And World War II was coming. And so they changed it to Timberlake. By the early 50s, it's clear from 1939 until then, it's clear that as boys and at that time, because Indian Brook had been founded in 1941, so not only male identified, but female identified campers moved up in age, that they wanted to be able to continue coming to camp and contributing. And so we established the senior work camp in the early 50s. And the Beyond Our Wildest Dreams goes on to say, "To judge from the lists of senior work campers' achievements recorded in the fair issue of that internationally famous publication, The Thunderbird, 1953 was a very busy, productive summer. Several of their projects are still in use. The big steel locomotive tire swinging from its sturdy frame at the lower side of Catamount Clearing and serving as a bell for Timberlake. The crowning and ditching of the new road to what was then Indian Brook, a symbol of the closer association of the camps. The fence along the lower side of the road took all summer. The posts had to be cut and soaked in creosote and holes dug for them in the stubborn, rocky soil. Only in 1974 was that fence taken down. There were many other projects, of course, such as improving the new garden, building proper cribbed up compost piles, cleaning and whitewashing the barn, they mean the lower barn, putting the brown stain and green trim on farm buildings, the redesign of the tool shed, which is later replaced by the present and much more durable maintenance building at Tamarack Farm. There was also forest clearance, drainage ditches behind the Timberlake Lodge, the care of our livestock, and the constant repair of Old Smoky, the pickup, which replaced Emma, a truck with a homemade body." So again, there, to me, not only are there just delightful word pictures of what campers were doing and of what our physical space was, or the physical space that we were creating, but also it gives a sense of the legacy of, we still do all of those things, cribbed up, building proper cribbed up compost piles, improving the gardens, putting brown stain and green trim. I just can't even, it's so quintessentially farm and wilderness. Forest clearance, drainage ditches behind Timberlake Lodge. Sorry, I don't mean to touch a sore point, but it has ever been a problematic location, clearly. Care of our animals. So all of that is stuff that these are all activities that we still do. And those activities reflect underlying values that we still have. The book goes on to talk about what we now call outdoor living skills, but campcraft and what disciplines campers need to have before they're allowed to go out on the trail. We start that at the barn day camp. Good heavens. I want to read from a story that a former camper contributed to Beyond Our Wildest Dreams that is not only reflective of values, but also is a great story about activities that we did then and we still do today. This was a camper who said, "We hiked from camp." This was somebody who was in First Lodge at the time. "We hiked from camp into the Coolidge State Forest, a long hike on the CCC, sorry, only three C's, CCC road." This is the road that goes up from Route 100 up to Shrewsbury. "During World War II, we carried our packs. There was no gas for trucking them in. For the little ones at that time, there had been a a practice of trucking their packs from point to point so that they were only doing the hiking. Packs were trucked in for the littlest ones, but the camper writes, the hike seemed endless and intolerable. Perhaps my first introduction to doing the impossible, if only you stick to it. We camped that night, somehow managed to cook and eat, although most of us were too tired to care. The next morning came and, what? These counselors wanted us to hike more? Absolutely impossible. Well, at least the hike was to be made without packs, as we left them in the overnight shelter. Somehow we got started. Somehow we made it. Somehow we made it back to camp, packs and all. No doubt the reason this event sticks firmly in my mind after all these years is that it was the first time I had been part of a group of kids who enjoyed, after it was over, an experience which was so exhausting and against which we so strongly objected verbally, and yet we did it. Having experienced that once, never again was an exhausting task impossible, for I know that the rewards of achievement are worth the stress of the effort. It was the epitome of the farm and wilderness experience. I get kind of teary reading that. Because, well, now we do have to clarify here. I am not a hiker. Under no circumstances do I ever want to hike. I love to go on canoe trips, but I do not hike. So I am filled with admiration for this particular camper and for completing the hike. But no doubt the reason this event sticks firmly in my mind after all these years is that it was the first time I had been part of a group of kids who enjoyed an experience which was so exhausting and against which we so strongly objected verbally. And yet, I find that really moving. He is also describing type 2 fun. They enjoyed it after it was over, but not at the time. Talking about the use of trucks, whether it's to go from one end of camp to the other, whether it's to go between the Plymouth Valley and Lake Nineveh, whether it's to go to the precursor to our fair. We are still here in the World War II years, and the book writes, one way in which the war was brought home to all in our idyllic isolation was in gas rationing. In 1941, we had discovered the Heartland Fair, one of the best of the old Vermont country fairs, and had managed to get the whole camp over to it. In 1942, gas rationing made that trip impossible. As often happens, the obstacle turned out to be a blessing. We would have our own fair, prepare a place for the display of stock, and invite youngsters from surrounding towns to bring in their livestock, some of it being raised for a 4-H club. So we started that in 1942. It's been a rough last 4 summers. We haven't been able to have the fair. And poor Francis, our executive director, still has not experienced a farm and wilderness fair. But by gummy, we are still rocking and rolling with the fair. I love to talk with people who donate to Farm and Wilderness. And many of the folks whom I talk with are folks who are long-term, stalwart, and generous donors, as I hope we all will be. And I recently had one of them ask me, now, do you still have those fried? And he stopped and I said, fried crickets and grasshoppers? Why, yes, we do. There are some things that about Farm and Wilderness that obviously, many things have changed, but there are some things that just do not change. So the book goes on to say, the fair was set up on the rolling meadow between the old barns and the lake. The stock pens were sited along the shore of the lake. The most spectacular attraction that first year was a prototype hay flyer in which little paddle boats, homemade and used on the waterfront, were for hand paddling, slid down a steep hay-lined chute under the giant arching limb of an old butternut tree onto what is now the fairgrounds field. And that's, if you are at the BDC on its front porch and you're going to keep the high flyer that goes on a zip line across the fairgrounds, if you're going to keep that on your right and you're going to go down those stone steps, the hay flyer came down on your left. There were games of chance on the midway, ingenious games of skill, which varied year to year according to the imagination of the campers, which the cabins which proposed them. So I'm eagerly looking forward to another Farm and Wilderness Fair this summer. So again, this talks about, I don't want to make it sound as if we had to turn every fun thing into something educational, because that just sounds like, who would want to go to a camp like that? But the fact is that we have so much fun, and everything that we do reflects our values. Our value of, I mean, the fair reflects our value primarily of community. Not only in that we're bringing community together, but in that the fair is a fundraiser for the funds that we raise for to give camperships, to give financial aid, so that everybody who wants to can have a transformational farm and wilderness summer. Let me talk about the spices specifically. In Beyond Our Wildest Dreams, I wrote, the values of farm and wilderness are expressed using the Quaker spices: simplicity, peacemaking, integrity, community, equity, and sustainability. What we try to give to our campers and staff begins with concern for others, that is, social concern, not just for each other here at camp, but in the world outside as well. That world does not make it easy to find oneself. It is such a competitive place that little seems to be done to help a child answer the question, who am I? Who am I? Each of us has to be comfortable with ourself before we can reach out to others. Too many children live with so much anger in their lives that it has been important to find one place where there is concern for each individual and where they can learn to share. The simple life has its special rewards. And again, then the book goes on to talk about, as I've already said, the challenge of learning new skills, which give a person a sense of self-worth and accomplishment, cooperation and the need for peace, the eternal verities of love, trust, and faith to climb mountains, both earthen and emotional ones, meditation, and a reverence for all life. We say that we are unplugged and unforgettable. I think it's worth continuing to bring us forward through the years and talking about one of the things that has made farm and wilderness historically so special. It does not necessarily set us apart from other New England nonprofit camps now, but certainly in the earliest years up through the 60s and early 70s, it did. And that was Grandma and Grandpa's absolute insistence upon welcoming Black campers, Palestinian as well as Israeli campers. After World War II, displaced persons, both Jewish and German children. There's a chapter in the book that talks about some of my grandparents' trips to the Deep South. If you're following along, I'm on starting on page 77. The editor of Parents Magazine was looking for camps open to Black children. Thanks to her, we enrolled 3 Black campers from North Carolina, and through this opportunity, our camper group began to expand to include Black and white campers from most of the large cities of the South. Martin Luther King Jr. was leading his march from Selma to Montgomery, and great activity was planned when the group supporting integration arrived in Montgomery. Ken and Susan, my grandparents, had planned a visit to Tuskegee Institute with 2 camp parents when the church in Birmingham was bombed. And they decided to continue their trip. And the people whom they were visiting, they were getting a mixed group. And by mixed group, they do not mean gender mixed. They mean racially mixed group together to watch camp movies. A woman named Margaret Fuller called. I don't want to alarm you, she said, but I think you should know that we've had several bombings of liberal churches in Burlington, and our church itself is under 24-hour police guard. Do you think you should risk it? Are you telling us not to come? Ken asked in return. Oh, not at all. We're sick about this, but we did think you should know. And you should realize also that probably the white friends we had lined up will think the danger too great. I don't know whether anyone will come. When Ken relayed this to Susan, she said, I think we should go. It's what we came south for. Well, thanks for alerting us, Kenstead said to Mrs. Fuller. But Susan feels with me that we came down here to do a job, and if you'll have us, we'd still like to come. Good, came the voice over the phone. We'll see what we can do to get together an audience. Our first visit in Birmingham was with Mabel Hicks, and that was Al Hicks's mom. They go on to write about how they arrived in Montgomery, Alabama, just as the Selma March was coming in. We were staying with the Clifford Durs. Clifford had been an official in Roosevelt's administration and was widely known as a fearless liberal and a highly competent lawyer. And during the evening, as we chatted, a number of phone calls came in for Clifford from young marchers who had run afoul of the police. The conversations were almost always the same, meaning that they were in trouble. They needed to be bailed out, or they needed somebody, more generally, they needed somebody to make sure that their civil rights were maintained, were observed. So they go on to talk more about that. But I think that that's a section of the book that speaks to, at the same time as my grandparents were very much of their era, they were tremendously courageous. They absolutely did lose enrollment because they insisted upon enrolling Black children in the camp. They knew that they did, and there's a further section of the book that talks about that. But this was part of their Quakerism, and they felt that this was an important value to uphold. Folks often ask me, is it really true that Malcolm X's kids came to camp? You can read about this in the book. Yes, some of Malcolm X's children came to camp. I went to camp with Quibilla and Attila. I served on staff at Tamarack Farm with Quibilla. And then there was a son who was at TL at the same time, but he was much younger. He was in First Lodge. I want to talk about a couple of other things that, of course, now many people, when they think of the Farm and Wilderness Camps, think of the Plymouth Camps on Woodward Reservoir. And as of 2018, the Farm and Wilderness Foundation affiliated with the Nineveh Foundation, and we are all now one. We have the same board of trustees, and we have two organizations, one for the camp programming, and that's Farm and Wilderness, and one for conservation programming, Farm and Wilderness Conservation. And we are now environmental caretakers of more than 5,000 combined acres of land and lake shoreline. We're part of one of the largest conservation efforts in Vermont as a large private landowner with conserved lands in the Forest Legacy Program. Trustees notice that our activities for campers and in the off-season are developing F&W's profile as a sound conservation organization. I recently attended a terrific program from Farm and Wilderness Conservation in partnership with the Vermont Center for Ecological Studies on loons. And we have a pair of nesting loons on Woodward Reservoir. So wonderful. They've been with us for 5 years. And we have, I believe it's three pairs, nesting pairs on Nineveh, which is obviously a much larger lake. I mean, how cool is that? Really? Like, for campers to be able to learn about nesting pairs and how can you tell whether there's a nest and how do we protect the nest and how do we keep boaters away? Like, how cool is that? I am here to tell you. So I get, as you can tell, I get very excited. But I also know that I am a birthright friend. My parents on both sides are Quakers. And my Quakerism is entirely informed by my childhood at Farm and Wilderness as a flying squirrel and then a bobolink, both of which combined to become the Barn Day Camp, at what is now Firefly Song. I was at Cacopa, which then became Dark Meadow. I then went back to, at the time, Indian Brook, now Firefly Song. I came back as staff, and then I served for 23 years on the Board of Trustees. My Quakerism is 100% informed by what Farm and Wilderness has given me. So I want to read again from the book, from another camper, about a camper's experience of what we used to call chapel. We now call it silent meeting. But the 15 minutes every day longer on Sundays, of silent meeting all together as a community. That camper writes, "There by the lake in the mountains, I learned something of the reciprocal relationship of pleasure and responsibility, the reliance of one on the other, and the creativity and worth of work. The other great gift Indian Brook left to me seemed equally pointless to start with, the silent meetings. Again, it was a matter of breaking through some invisible barrier. On the one side, anxiety, restlessness, and boredom. On the other side, peace and happiness of a new kind. It may seem a cruelty at first to inflict on people what they dislike and resist, but it depends on what is being inflicted, who is choosing the matter and the method. The Webbs had a perfect gift for it, for how gently to convey to a bunch of lazy, crazy children a foundation of meaning." It wasn't just the Webbs who had, it was not just my grandparents who had, as this camper writes, a perfect gift for it. Our camp directors and our staff have a perfect gift for it. I have been fortunate to work at Firefly Song the last two summers for a couple of weeks each summer, and I watched this. The camp director, Clarissa, and the staff have a perfect gift for how to gently convey to a bunch of children and young adults a foundation of meaning. The book goes on to write, "Meeting gives time for meditation. In its silence, there is peace. Campers begin to understand many Quaker values, and these become a part of their lives. Perhaps the lasting friendships formed first at Farm and Wilderness have been the greatest gift of all. Campers speak, most of all, of the countless friends they have made. Just meeting someone in the grocery store or at a friend's meeting in another part of the world is exciting and begins the exchanging of memories." And W, I'm sure you can speak to this. I know I can. I live now in North Carolina where there are not a lot of F&W alumni, but I'm a psychologist, and part of being a psychologist is that for several years I taught psychology at a local community college. And there I am one day, I was either in general psychology or psychopathology. I can't remember. I think it was general psychology. And I was giving an example of something, which I don't even remember what it was, because what happened next was so startling. I think I was talking about altruism as empathy and altruism as desirable values in human beings. And I gave examples of doing chores together and, you know, building community together in a summer camp. And all of a sudden, this young woman sat straight up and kind of blurted out, "Are you talking about the Farm and Wilderness camps?" And trust me when I tell you, you know, up home when I wear an F&W hoodie or a t-shirt, five people on the street will stop me and say, "Oh, F&W, I went there. My mom went there." This does not happen here. I was gobsmacked. I'm not sure actually which of us was more taken aback, she or I. And so when it says just meeting someone in the grocery store or at a friend's meeting or in a classroom in another part of the world, it's exciting and it begins the exchanging of memories. And those memories include not only values, but specific activities. And I think those are timeless, and those speak to the impact that we continue to have 85 years later and ongoingly. When you reached out to me, W, and asked me if I would consider coming on the podcast, and you reminded me that this is our 85th anniversary. And it's, of course, it's TL's 85th anniversary. It was the first camp, but that means that it's the 85th anniversary of all of Farm and Wilderness. How amazing is that? Anyway, I began to think, all right, so what would I want to choose from Beyond Our Wildest Dreams? What I want to emphasize, and the pieces that I chose seem to fall into two categories. One, I was looking for pieces that explicated, that talked about our timeless values, whether we describe them in terms of the spices or we describe them in other terms as grandma and grandpa did originally. To begin with, we agreed that there must be challenge in the program. I think I mentioned at some point that grandpa got the idea for a summer camp, even though he'd always wanted to have a school, but he got the idea of a summer camp when he was teaching at the American University in Beirut. And he was asked one summer to run a summer camp for boys who had been displaced by the Armenian genocide. And in the book, he writes, Ken got the message of these hardy youngsters. Life can be clean and strong and joyous with simple, hearty meals, with none of the gadgetry that clutters our lives, and without the frantic search for pleasure, which often leaves us drifting without purpose. Unwittingly, these boys were setting part of the pattern for a camp in the States, which would start many years later. And so I was looking for sections that I could quote that described those really timeless values and how grandma and grandma articulated them and how we articulate them now and how similar those are, or not exactly the same. I also looked for selections that would describe activities that we did then that we still do, or traditions we had then that we still have today. I loved reading, being reminded of how the TL Bell was brought to us, 1953. I loved reading about the construction of some of the buildings. And that makes me think of how many campers have been able to bang a few nails into the siding of a new cabin or a kaibo, or get up on the roof of a new cabin or kaibo and shingle it. And how for us, the work projects program, the farm program are not just about production. It's not that we have a staff who does all of that for us. We do that ourselves. So I was looking for examples of that, that things that carry on 85 years later. As we look to our next 85 years, which I'm 100% confident we are going to make, and probably I'll be on the board of trustees again for all 85 of them, apparently, the things that I'm looking forward to us continuing, obviously our Quakerism and our spices, our Quaker roots, our Quaker values, as reflected in the spices. We are nothing if not examples of cheerful durability. The summer of 2023 was a terrific example of that. We had apocalyptic flooding. Both sets of camps were completely cut off for some period of time. We were not able to swim or boat in either lake for some period of time. And yet programming went on. It was different, but programming went on. Campers were cheerful. Campers were protected from knowing what was happening in the outside world. Staff were exhausted, but bless them, they rose to the occasion and then some. And this was after a summer of pandemic. And then we were hit with norovirus. So cheerful durability. We're like Weeblos, right? You hit us and we just bounce right back up. And I think that the specifically resiliency in the form of climate, our response to climate change is going to be an essential part of the next 85 years. I think that we have to be prepared for extremes of weather. I think we're already preparing for example, our trips are closer to home so that we don't have to spend money on gas. It's just like back during World War II, so that we don't have to spend money on long distance trips. I really hope, and I do believe, that we'll maintain our very positive relationship with the Akwesasne Mohawk tribe up in St. Regis, New York, whose executive director, Jalesa, is the grandson of Wakio Racinus, whom we knew as Flying Cloud. But I think, you know, the farm will still be there. The wilderness, we are preserving the wilderness. That is on us. Vermont is a state that makes that pretty easy. But that's our responsibility, those 5,000 plus or minus acres of lands and waters. And the people, bringing children and young people to our cabins, tents, longhouses, yurts, poncho shelters, to our kayaks and canoes, to our waterfronts, to our farm and our animals, bringing them there to practice work is love made visible, to practice community, and to form those lasting, binding relationships. I don't think any of that's going to change. I just don't think we're going to lose that. I'm a living example of that, in fact. My history with camp is slightly different from that of many other people. I didn't have a choice. I came to camp when I was 5. My mom was the person who created the counselor apprentice program at what is now Firefly Song. She was 9 months pregnant, well, 8 months when we arrived, with my sister, and went up and down that hill, well, up and down Pooh Hill from the lodge to Top of the Forest, CA, and the tent platform where she and I lived that summer. My sister was born at the end of camp on the same day as my grandmother and grandma's twin sister's birthday, August, in the middle of August. I was in Flying Squirrels. Then there was Bobolinks, which was a day camp program. I went all the way through what was then Indian Brook. I had 3 summers where I did half season at what is now Firefly and half season at what was first Cocopa and then became Dark Meadow. I took a couple of summers off instead of going to the farm. One of those summers, I went to a wilderness tripping program 350 miles north of Quebec City for a 7-week canoe trip, which I loved. And it was my first chance to escape farm and wilderness. And my 2 trip leaders were longtime farm and wilderness staff members. When I was 8 and in crickets and Todd was 9 and in at TL in a cabin that was in those days called Wigwam, he asked me to dance at a square dance in the TL Upper Lodge. And he says that he asked me to dance because I looked like I would say yes. And I was like Charlie Brown's cute little redhead. The boys had been told that even though the girls had cooties, that they had to ask a girl to dance. So we held hands all that summer. And on the last night of camp, there is the banquet. And in those days, the fair was on a Saturday and the banquet was on the following Wednesday night. Thursday was the last day of camp. So Wednesday night. And at both what's now Firefly, I'm just going to keep calling it Firefly and TL. If you had been part of a couple during the summer, you were each given 1/2 of a red construction paper heart with the other person's name on it to signify the broken heart that you would have during the winter when you would be separated. And so we each got 1/2 of a red construction paper heart with the other one's name on it. And, I, of course, hung on to mine. He, being a 9-year-old boy, promptly crumpled his up and threw it in the nearest bush. And, we maintained contact with each other through the winter time, through Christmas cards and phone call or two. Then when I was in Birch's cabin at Firefly and he was at Tamarack Farm, we were sweethearts again, and we spent the entire summer in the apple orchard. Now, we were definitely not supposed to be doing this, but again, my camp experience was a little bit different than other people's. I was the granddaughter of the founders. Who was going to tell me that I couldn't be there? So all that summer in the apple orchard, and he then was invited to call square dances, which he had learned to do at Farm and Wilderness from Jack Bailey at South Street Seaport in New York City. And so he went off and did that, and we never lost touch with each other. He was the second person whose email address I had back in the days when we called it electronic mail. And in 1991, he was the music and dance coordinator, and his kids were at the BDC. I didn't know that, and I came up to camp to see my folks and ran into him on the road, and we spent the entire afternoon talking with each other at my dad's house. And I learned later on that my stepmom later said to my dad, "Now, why couldn't those two have gotten married?" His marriage had ended. My marriage had, but I was the only one who didn't know it yet. And we continued to stay in touch. And when I was in graduate school in New Hampshire, his dad had died, and he came up from here in North Carolina with one of his daughters who'd been born in New Hampshire, where I was in graduate school at Antioch. And, you know, he said to New York to help his mom close up the house. And he, you know, wrote me and he said, could we just come up for the day? She wants to see me to New Hampshire. My daughter wants to see New Hampshire. Sure. So they came up, but it was December. It was between Christmas and New Year's. And what is the one thing that is absolutely predictable in New Hampshire between Christmas and New Year's? There was a snowstorm and they got snowed in, which was fine. I was delighted. So they spent the weekend with me. And at the end of the weekend, as they had gotten back to Long Island, he called me up to let me know that they were there safely. And he said to me, you know, I've always been in love with you. And I'm still in love with you. And I know that I'm in North Carolina and you're in grad school in New Hampshire, but would you consider a long distance relationship? And I said, you just keep on talking to me. We didn't even have cell phones then. It's 1993. But I had a cordless phone and I walked up in my apartment building up into the attic where I had a storage unit. So you just keep on talking. And I unlocked my storage unit and I threaded my way through boxes and I came to a filing cabinet and opened the top drawer and I walked my fingers through my files. And I said, I have here in my hand, my half of a red construction paper heart. Where have you been? I've been waiting. So we were married just not that many years later in the apple orchard, scene of our misspent youth, on the day before camp opened. And it wouldn't have happened without Farm and Wilderness. It couldn't have. For which I'm internally grateful to Farm and Wilderness for that. I mentioned that Todd learned to call square dances at camp. And so I also think about some things that we used to do that we don't do anymore, some of which we will never do again. Some of which, yeah, I can dream. I'd love to have us do some of those things again. One thing we will never do again is that many years ago, in the earliest days of Firefly, there was a horseback riding program, but only campers who were on campership couldn't afford it. And so the campers all got together and said, yeah, no, we have to stop this because if everybody can't do it, then nobody should be able to do it. And so they did away with that. We did used to have a really strong music and dance program. For people who know anything about square dancing, New England square dancing and contra dancing, the name Dudley Laufman is a name to conjure with. Dudley, astoundingly, my God, he's got to be 92 years old. He is still around. And he was at Farm and Wilderness. He was on our staff at doing other things. I think he was the farmer for a number of years and called dances there. There are many other people who learned to call at Farm and Wilderness, whether it's square dances or contras. So now square dancing is much less frequent. Although thanks to Marcus and Mary, we do have contra dances and they are a feature of family camp and work weekends. And of course, everybody, I'm just going to read from the book. Everyone, campers, staff, alumni, and parents looks forward to the dance on the soccer field near the fairgrounds just before the fair's bonfire. Zodiac, Tennessee Wigwalk, even a salty dog rag to homemade music are all sources of joy for dancers and watchers alike. Canned music has largely been kept out of the camps. We've developed our own special style of entertainment that ranges from the F&W string band to Sam Camp skits to the Firefly song Coco House, where young performers can shine. I'd love to see regular weekly dances brought back. I think it was a terrific intercamp activity. I think the string band, I'd love to see the string band be more formally resurrected. I love the service trips that Tamarack Farm used to do. And at the same time, you know, the reimagining of, say, Tamarack Farm, the reimagining that we're doing of Red Spruce Grove and Flying Cloud right now is so exciting to me. I'm so excited to see what is next.
And that was my conversation with Christy Webb, former board member and granddaughter of the founders of Farm and Wilderness, Ken and Susan Webb. If you'd like to register, apply for a job at, or just learn more, check out farmandwilderness.org. We're on YouTube, Instagram, TikTok, and this podcast. Thanks to our guest, Christy. Original music by Emmett Powers. Recording and editing done by myself. Thanks to everyone at Farm and Wilderness who help make our summers possible. And with that, remember, camp magic is real, y'all. Until next time.